want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful to the people who support this program by subscribing. People like Diane Morris, Steve Wozenski, Aaron Blair, and Raymond Welch. You can do it too. All the details are under my picture. Follow the links on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment of today's podcast, we're going to take a trip down the Mississippi, down to New Orleans, and take a look at the post-Katrina recovery efforts and the extent to which privatized approaches to disaster relief are, well, really problematic, and a lot of the money earmarked for the victims of Katrina never quite trickled down to those actual victims. That's coming up in our second segment today. But first, I want to welcome to our program Lieutenant Colonel Darrell Vandeveld. He is an attorney in the United States military. He serves in the Army Reserve. And he just completed a very difficult trial at the Joint Base Lewis-McChord in the state of Washington. We're going to talk about that. Welcome to our program, Colonel.
Thank you, Peter.
And may I begin by talking about you and thanking you for your service at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and your principled resignation as a prosecutor at the military tribunals.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, these sort of experiences shape one, and my experiences certainly have done that to me. I think I've become more humane and understanding, but still there are rough spots that remain.
And may I tell you, we've never met before, and I have been covering the issues of Guantanamo, what I call the kangaroo courts of the military tribunals, the plight of the men, 166, who are trapped there, many of whom have already been cleared for release. And, you know, I spoke at great length a year or so ago with one of your former colleagues, Morris Davis, and it really helped me understand that there are real humans who populate the lawyer corps, the judge advocate generals and their equivalents in the other services, and that there are people who stand for the principles of law and our Constitution. And when you did so, under the circumstances of being a uniformed officer and subject to the chain of command, and nevertheless, you rejected the idea that convictions, for example, as Colonel Morris Davis told us, were a foregone conclusion. And so I don't know all the particulars of your particular case and why you resigned, but it really means a lot to me that people who wear the uniform do not lose their humanity and their respect for constitutional rule when they participate in the military justice system.
Right, and you have to separate the military commissions from the establishment of Guantanamo. And Guantanamo as a whole, I think everyone agrees, was a bad idea. I mean, it was an attempt to evade the constitutional protections that would otherwise be afforded detainees who would be tried for what are essentially federal crimes. And so while the military commissions themselves have gone through, I think, four iterations now, and they're still stalled in the courts, the idea that Guantanamo should be closed is one that even the president just recently restated. And when he was first running, reality. The military commissions, though, I have been improved to the point where they resemble military courts-martial. I mean, there are only a few differences. They're not extreme differences, but and I expect that they'll be around for a while. But
well, I appreciate that comment, Colonel. I'm still very skeptical, particularly when we saw the scene earlier this year in the pretrial proceedings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, when the judge running the courtroom wasn't able to control the censorship apparatus that blocked the feed to journalists and other observers at certain points in testimony. And that's just one example of the way it appears to me to be much more criminal justice theater as opposed to a solid system where the rights of the suspects are honored and that you can't use hearsay evidence and you cannot manipulate the proceedings for a predetermined outcome. So I respect what you're telling us, that the system has been improved, but I remain skeptical that these are processes that we'll look back at in 20 years and say, yeah, that was justice.
Well, I think you have to separate the concept from its application. And, you know, there have been obvious and well-publicized difficulties in implementing the system. I mean, there are emails that were written between the defense lawyers and others and their experts were inadvertently turned over to the prosecution. That was obviously embarrassing. There was eavesdropping, apparently, available in the attorney-client meeting rooms at Guantanamo when it was specifically represented to the court, the commissions, that it wasn't going on. So you have to separate what are, I think, essentially human errors from the construct itself. Although, you know, I can't disagree with your assessment either, because I think there have been a total of, six successful prosecutions since the first tribunals were established in 2003.
Yeah.
It's not a very effective system at this point.
Mm-hmm. And what have been the repercussions for you personally since you resigned in 2008, Colonel?
Oh, you know, for the first time, my professionalism and integrity were questioned, traduced in the media by military officers, which is something that is just really never done. I mean, a superior never comments about a subordinate in public, and certainly not in a public forum. And yet that was done, and it actually took me so completely by surprise, I have to admit I didn't react very well. And I think I responded in kind. In retrospect, I wouldn't do it exactly the way that I did do it. The Air Force, it turns out, is much more savvy, I guess, in these sort of matters. They had prosecutors resign, and they just simply let them go. They didn't set out to destroy their credibility by coming up with factually false charges, which is what happened in my case.
Now, I understand you were passed over for promotion. Was it quite overt, the reasons?
Oh, I'm certain it was, yeah. I'm positive that it was.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But, I barely... lasting animosity about that. I mean, I'm a reservist. It's not my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud to serve, and I'm proud that the military as a whole, and the Army in particular, have traditions that people strive every day to maintain. You know, the Army is at least one institution, public institution, that talks about values, and I think that there's a, that's estimable.
Mm-hmm. And Lieutenant Colonel Vandeveld, before we dive into the most recent case that you've handled, give us a quick overview of your legal career, both in and outside the military. How long have you been practicing law, and roughly how many cases have you handled, either as a prosecutor or a defense attorney?
Yeah, I became a lawyer in 1986 when I graduated from the University of California, and I started out working for a large law firm. I did that for 4 years, basically to make money, and I found it to be intellectually bereft. You know, you spend so much time doing nothing but drudge work, and I began to see it as kind of an institutional victimized fraud and couldn't wait to get out of there. And so I joined the San Diego County District Attorney's Office, where I probably prosecuted 50 cases. And then my wife and I began to have children, and we still wanted to travel in Europe. That was one of my dreams. And so I went on active duty in the JAG Corps for 3 years and did that in Germany, did maybe 20, 22 court-martials. And then after that, I came back to Erie and started with the Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office, where I've retired from. And in the course of my career, I think I've probably tried about 150 cases. Although as you get older as a lawyer and more experienced, you end up in supervisorial roles, and you don't try as many cases. And frankly, there are skills that atrophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so these past 18 months have certainly been an object demonstration of that in my case. So, yeah, and then I became a public defender after,
mm-hmm.
And I've, I can't even count how many cases I've tried.
And where did you work as a PD, also in Pennsylvania?
Erie, Pennsylvania. It's mm-hmm. a remote little outpost in the northwest corner of Pennsylvania, right on Lake Erie.
Oh, I've been there. It's the gateway to the New York State Thruway for me.
Well, that's how a lot of people know it, yeah. A lot of people say, well, I've been through there.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, Colonel, we're going to talk about a case that you recently handled there at the Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and for some very good reasons. We're going to be a little circumspect in our discussion. I've agreed not to name the individual that you represented, but people can easily do a couple of online searches to get more detail. What is important is the piece that you wrote that shows a great deal of compassion and empathy in a very difficult case. And this is what is termed a fratricide, where a member of the U.S. military was accused and convicted of killing five fellow service members. And what you have offered us is something that we don't get in any of the coverage from the corporate media, and that is context and a little bit of depth. So I'd like to hand it over to you here and take as long as you'd like, but please describe the various emotions that you expressed in this commentary piece, and I will link to it with your permission in the show file that is connected to this podcast at peterbcollins.com so that our listeners can read your commentary. But please, as I say, take a few minutes and describe some of the details of the case and some of the backstory, the details that surfaced that take this out of a cut-and-dried, black-and-white kind of case, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to disappoint your expectations, but I really can't talk about the particulars of any case, which is still ongoing. But what I can talk about is the process of handling a case that involves such tragedy. I mean, many of the cases that I prosecuted and those that I defended were crimes against persons, but never really to the level of, the case which you've referenced. And a lot of the cases didn't involve anything more than drug use and stealing. And so the emotions that the defense lawyer or the prosecutor feels are completely different. And while they don't change the strategy of the case or the approach to the case, I think they leave a lasting effect on someone as long as they're sentient human beings. So when you deal with any kind of case that involves injury to another person, the tendency is to, on the part of the public, and as one person put it, that very angry blonde-haired woman who appears on television all the time, who thinks everybody is guilty, guilty, guilty.
We are allowed to name Nancy Grace and take pot shots at her, okay?
Well, that's who the commentator was referring to, as a matter of fact. They tend to lose sight of the fact that defense lawyers are humans, too, and that while their first obligation and foremost obligation is to his or her client, they can't become separated from human suffering involved in cases. And I'd been deployed to several different places, as a soldier, and certainly seen things that would tend to leave one hardened and perhaps callous. But what I found, in handling any kind of case that involves, I'm being very general here, victims, human victims of violence, is that it leaves an indelible mark on one. And too often, I think people conflate the defense lawyer with the acts that the defendant is accused of having committed. And there's a saying in the death penalty community that I think Stephen Bright, prominent death penalty lawyer, says, is that no one should be judged by the worst 15 minutes or so of their lives. And that's his argument against capital punishment. And I happen to agree with that. I mean, and certainly the sentencing scheme that takes place in the capital context takes that into consideration and allows for the presentation to a jury or a court-martial panel of the total picture of a defendant, or as they call them in the military, the accused. So as a lawyer sitting at the counsel table, you have to temper, I think, the emotions that you feel and set them aside, suppress them, and concentrate on strategy and tactics that are best for your client. It's not an effort to avoid the truth. It's an effort to make the panel or the court-martial or the jury see the truth. And to see the truth in any case involving violence necessarily means showing the accused and his background to the extent possible. Because crimes are not committed in a vacuum, and violent crimes, except for those we would call psychopaths, are committed by ordinary human beings who snap or find themselves in positions where they have to make quick judgments, and they end up doing something that they will regret for the rest of their lives, and that leads to lasting impacts, not just on the victims, but on the victim's survivors. And that's what I've tried to convey.
Well, Colonel, first of all, I am not a Nancy Grace character, and I believe that every criminal defendant in civilian or military courts deserves a robust and aggressive defense. And that does not mean that you use unethical means or lies or other forms of dishonesty to try to protect your client, but that you have an affirmative obligation to do your very best to represent their best interests and to convey to the court, to the extent possible under the rules, the full story of the events as they occurred. So first, can you tell me just in a broad way, does the military justice system have an equivalent to the civilian state laws related to diminished capacity as a defense in the event of a psychotic type crime?
Yes. In fact, speaking of robustness, they're actually a little more powerfully stated in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the rules for courts martial, and also the case law. Diminished capacity is an imprecise term, but what it means in the military context is that one's mental state can be such that he or she cannot form the specific intent to commit a crime or to act with premeditation in the case of murder. And I think it's actually easier to establish in military courts than it is in civilian courts. What's interesting is that I think it was earlier this year that the United States Supreme Court upheld the state of Idaho's decision to ban any kind of insanity defense. So there's no constitutional right to present an insanity defense. The military calls it a lack of mental responsibility, and follows a vastly different system for making that determination. First, they send the accused to a board called the Rule for Court-Martial 706 Sanity Board, which is comprised of psychiatrists and usually two psychologists, one a clinical psychologist and the other a psychologist who does psychometric testing. And there they try to answer the question of whether the person meets the legal definition of insanity, which I think across the country is pretty much the same. It's the old Macnaughton test, where if one lacks the substantial capacity to appreciate the nature and quality of his act or the wrongfulness of it, then he or she can't be found guilty of the crime, because obviously there's no point in punishing someone who's so mentally ill they don't know what they're doing or they don't know it to be wrong. And so if this sanity board makes that determination, then a prosecution could still go forward, but what's more likely is that the individual would be turned over to the Attorney General and sent to a federal medical center until his or her sanity is restored.
Mm-hmm.
It happens very infrequently. There's absolutely no equivalent in the civilian sphere, as far as I know.
All right. And how would you characterize the ability of the healthcare system in the military, particularly in forward deployment zones or war zones, in dealing with combat-related psychological conditions, broadly talked about as PTSD, but taking on many characteristics of depression and other kinds of symptoms? Because, you know, we've seen in more than one case where individuals who were having serious problems and sought treatment basically got hammered by the system that they had turned to for help. So if you could, tell us your view of the availability of psychological and psychiatric care for troops in combat zones and the extent to which they become, the, in particular military psychiatrists, operate with a kind of tough love or military mindset instead of a more perhaps a civilian approach of empathy, compassion, and an effort to really hear what the needs of the patient are.
Yeah, you know, the approach that was taken in Iraq from 2003 onward was modeled after what the military always called the Israeli approach, which is to keep soldiers who are suffering from, post-traumatic stress or combat stress as close to their units as possible and as close to, the fighting as possible, while still affording them a safe haven for brief treatment, with the goal being to return them to their units as quickly as possible, because that's what the Israelis found to be the most effective. Because, if you evacuate somebody immediately and send them, in the case of the Iraq War or Afghanistan, back to the United States, it's likely they'll never return. And they the thinking was that they would develop this kind of victim mentality. And certainly we saw that early on in some of the instances where soldiers who had been traumatized by what they had seen were ordered back out on missions and they refused to go, and they were subject to being court-martialed for refusal to obey a direct order, or showing cowardice in the face of the enemy, whatever fence, the military dreamed up. But as things evolved, it became clearer that a lot of the stresses of these forward deployments in Iraq, they didn't arise so much from combat as the combat activities declined, but rather the stresses from being away from home, from being away from family, from being isolated for long periods of time. And so Army psychiatry, I can't speak for the other services, began to see the problems as what they called occupational or home front issues, which is really a diminishment of what are truly symptoms and what are situations in which compassion and empathy are needed most. And also what happened in 2009 in Iraq, when there wasn't much combat going on, is that, inevitably, the Army had to put into these positions, these behavioral health positions, psychologists and psychiatrists who really weren't qualified. And some of them had served several tours themselves and were suffering themselves from what they call compassion or empathy fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And they treated soldiers as, they began to see soldiers as suffering from these, you know, workplace conflicts or home front issues, rather than as the product of repeated deployments in which they probably had experienced combat or seen traumatic things, and were in need of compassion and were in need of empathy, and yet didn't get it simply because the provider had a preconceived notion about them. And so while the intentions were good, once again, the execution failed.
Mm-hmm. And in a case of someone who is deployed, you know, we can be a little more specific here, is deployed in a place like Iraq and who is experiencing very serious psychological issues, an encounter with a psychiatrist who minimizes the situation, maybe just tries to push some medications on the individual, it can lead to a very traumatic situation. And it seems to me, again, speaking somewhat broadly here to try to honor your limitations, that the media tries to or tends to reduce these issues just to very simple recitation of the facts and no dimension on the level of stress on an individual, the repeated tours, the real price that extracts from our service members, particularly those who had only signed up for the reserves or the National Guard, who ended up on repeat deployments during the first decade of this century. So talk a little bit about these triggers and the lack of depth or detail of these issues when they are covered and reported to the American people.
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's important to note that fewer than 1% of the American population served in the Iraq or Afghan wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, there isn't broad public understanding or even in the case of Iraq, much public memory of what the war was all about and the toll that it took on the, you know, the 1% or less who actually did deploy several, you know, times to either theater of combat. Also, you know, as civilians, it's difficult to get a grasp of what a deployment entails. I mean, there's this wrenching departure from one's family and from their surroundings to a place where, you know, there really are no front lines. You're in danger constantly. You know, you're surrounded by, you know, men and women carrying weapons, you know, loaded weapons. There are rounds going off all the time, shells dropping in the forward operating bases. And, you know, while you may not be in any immediate direct danger, death could come at any moment. And that, so even if you're working, driving a supply truck, you know, you're still in danger. And, you know, the human psyche can only take that for so long. And then, you know, in the case of some soldiers who've deployed, say, five times, they'd come back, and there was supposed to be what we would call, you know, dwell time or reset time. But in fact, what would happen is that, you know, rather than rest and recuperate, the units would begin training immediately for yet another deployment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, soldiers moved around from unit to unit, and it wasn't unusual for somebody to be transferred to a unit right after deployment to a unit that was about to deploy. So there'd be very little time spent at home.
And we've seen the pathologies play out as soldiers came home in terms of domestic violence, alcoholism, other forms of self-medication, and other forms of acting out. And I feel that we have failed both in the medical system in the military and at the Veterans Administration, to properly address these very urgent concerns. So as you look at this from the point of view of a defense lawyer, how do you think that we need to address these shortcomings? If you were to tick off, you know, three or four quick proposals, what do we need to do to really honor our commitment to those who are currently or recently have served?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting and what I think is probably most helpful is already occurring is expanding, and that is the idea of establishing what are called problem-solving courts. They exist for drug abusers or drug addicts. You know, they call them drug courts or treatment courts. But also, what's happened is that the under the auspices of the VA and other elements of the federal government, there's been a push to establish veterans courts, which you know, would not relieve somebody who's served overseas from criminal culpability that exists, but rather would provide them with a treatment model and rehabilitation rather than simply punishment. And for the kind of offenses that you're talking about, those that are have their roots in post-traumatic stress and all the consequences that follow from that,
mm-hmm.
alcoholism, drug use, and so on, because those are problems that can be addressed and that can be treated. And the Veterans Administration, I don't call it the Veterans Administration anymore, it's the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Right. Still the VA. We can still call it the VA.
Yeah. The VA, yes. you know, they're constantly striving to make improvements in their treatment models, and more federal dollars have been directed toward the VA and to trying to address some of these problems. And so the establishment of veterans courts, I think, is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not to give a veteran a get-out-of-jail-free card. So I've heard some people, you know, deride the notion.
Well, Colonel, anybody who reads the essay that I'm going to post with this podcast, I think will see that you're very balanced, because in your description of the issues that resulted from this case, you're very even-handed. You certainly do reflect the interests and concerns and the case history of your client, but you offer no excuses for the loss of life and the carnage that occurred here. And so I don't think you have to worry, at least from my perspective, about being tagged that way.
Yeah, I mean, once again, it goes back to the idea that you can be a very zealous advocate for your client while at the same time remaining human, and I think that a combination of the two in these kind of tragic cases is what's necessary.
Mm-hmm. So, Colonel, let me ask about you. What kind of stresses do you feel from handling a fairly high-profile and extremely difficult case like this most recent one?
Well, they can be very wearing, and you have to be alert to the effects of stress yourself, and take common sense measures to avoid or mitigate them. And you know, that can take the form of exercise or meditation or, you know, anything to distract and recharge as you go along, because certainly a tired, stressed out lawyer is no good for his client.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I attempted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I succeeded. I mean, I'm fine.
Okay. And what are your own intentions? Do you plan to remain active in the military justice system as a reservist?
I want to get out as soon as possible.
Okay.
I was supposed to retire like 2 years ago, and actually I'm beyond my mandatory retirement date. I'm just waiting for my orders to put me into retirement, so I'm finished. I think I've done my part, and if that sounds so I harbor some sort of animus or rancor toward the military, I don't. I mean, I'm proud of my service, but the time has come for me to go, as Al Gore said, after the Bush versus Gore decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for me me to go.
All right. Well, we don't need a Supreme Court ruling in your case, but I will thank you if this is an approach to the end of your military legal career. I really appreciate what you have offered us in terms of your expression of feelings about this most recent case. And as I began, I want to thank you for your service and your principled stand up to and including your resignation as a prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Well, thank you. Whatever I can do to help out veterans, I'll do.
Okay. We've been talking with Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandeveld here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Can I just make one final comment?
Sure.
And that is that my views are my own. They don't represent those in the Department of Defense, the Army, or any other governmental entity.
We've got that, and you said it loud enough so that my minder at the NSA has picked it up, too.
All right.
Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's take a little trip down south to New Orleans. And we're going to take a look back at the aftermath and the recovery from Hurricane Katrina. Dr. John's here to get us started.
Been blown down to New Orleans on the winds of despair, where music and laughter once filled the air. Got a graveyard and ghosts, politicians stand in the city they care for God. Everything's sacred, been strung up and shot.
New Orleans, the city that care forgot. That's Dr. John, and he did a great CD release a few years ago that really impressed me, and this is the title track, The City That Care Forgot. And we'll bring you another couple of tunes as we talk with Professor Vince Ann Adams. She's at the University of California, San Francisco, professor of medical anthropology in the Department of Anthrohistory and Social Medicine. Her new book is called Markets of Sorrow, Labors of Faith, New Orleans in the Wake of Katrina. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think you have put together a very interesting book that takes a look not really at the hurricane and the specific damage that occurred, but at the efforts to rebuild New Orleans after Katrina. And some of your findings really, I think, are very important and actually stunned me, because I thought I had followed the relief efforts and Michael Brown, Brownie, the guy who ran FEMA, and some of the other characters, Mayor Nagin, who's now in prison, other characters who populate the Louisiana scene. But you kind of peel back the layers on who actually came and who stayed, as we say, after the TV cameras left. Now, tell me about your own personal interest in New Orleans and in the plight of the people who were hammered by Hurricane Katrina and by the flooding, which really was what did the damage, the post-hurricane flooding.
Well, I actually had a very long career in anthropology working in another part of the world, Tibet and Nepal and China. And I was asked to take over this project for a colleague who passed away unexpectedly. And so it was my first experience actually working in the U.S. So what was familiar suddenly had to be made unfamiliar to me. And when I first went to New Orleans, it was about 18 months after the receding of the floods. And I realized that right away there was something interesting going on here that would surprise me as an American who had heard about New Orleans but never really gotten to know it. And over the course of 5 years when I did this research, I got to know New Orleanians and I got to know the city and I got to know a lot more about how they offered not just me, but everyone in America, a chance to understand more about what was going on in America.
Mm-hmm.
The aftermath of the floods and the rebuilding effort, the failed rebuilding effort, and then the ultimately successful effort, told me a story about what was going on in the changing structure of governance in America. And I really got to know and love the people of New Orleans over the course of this project. I feel like I would like to live there in my retirement years. My daughter goes to school there. Mm-hmm. Every year I brought people down to do rebuilding work and volunteer work. And so I have a very, very soft spot for the city now and for all the people there.
Can you make a beignet?
No, I'm not a chef. I'll leave that to the experts in New Orleans. But and I love the music, too, but I'm not going to pick up an instrument soon.
Now, first of all, in the big picture, how is New Orleans today different from New Orleans pre-Katrina? It's a smaller population, and it's a different composition of people, isn't it?
What most reports are talking about, suggest that just those things. There are a lot of the demographics have shifted around the loss of a large number of African American, especially working or underclass African Americans, those who were in part-time labor positions, and especially those who received government subsidies for some of their housing because mm-hmm. they were in part-time labor positions, who left and weren't able to come back. And the replacement of some of those people with immigrants from other parts of the world, Mexican immigrants in particular, Hispanic laborers. And there are other newcomers arriving as well. A lot of the volunteers from middle class and, youth groups that came down there have decided to settle in New Orleans and raise their families there. And, you know, real estate is affordable in some of the areas that were really devastated, and so they're immigrating. So there has been a demographic shift. There are fewer people.
So there's some are permanently displaced, or they just gave up and left.
A lot of people gave up and left.
Mm-hmm.
Most neighborhoods where home ownership was the norm, the best rebuilding estimates are that they're about 76% back.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of those are inhabited by people who lived there before.
Yeah.
So a significant number of people just couldn't afford to come back, mm-hmm. didn't get the kind of resources they needed to rebuild, and took what they were offered and rebuilt somewhere else, moved to another place.
So there has been a displacement of poor people who had called New Orleans their home for generations. And as you're going to describe, there was a massive corporate involvement in the relief efforts. They took government money, fed it to corporations, and then some of that money actually made it to those who needed the relief. And we'll go into some detail about that. But who are the architects of the redesigned New Orleans with less Section 8 housing, with less room for the poor people, who were a major element of the population there before Katrina?
So a lot of these plans were started long before Katrina, and Katrina just speeded the process along. There's a great book out by John Arena. I can't remember the name in a minute. And he documents this as well. But this, people in New Orleans all know that the program to get rid of a lot of the lower-income housing was on the books before Katrina. Katrina came, and it gave the city the opportunity to work with HUD to get people out of all of this housing. So even those lower-income housing units that were not flooded were forced, people who lived in them were forced to evacuate. And metal plates were put up on their windows and doors. They were forced to live in FEMA trailers hours outside of the city in some cases without any transportation into the city unless they had a car of their own.
Mm-hmm.
These were like relocation camps almost. It was horrible to see them.
Yeah.
They had an armed guard at the gate. So these people were never allowed back into their homes in some cases. And there were a lot of public protests about this. There were a lot of open trials in the city courthouses about it. But basically, the city plans to get rid of this housing and turn it into multi-income development housing units was pushed through.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them, except for one, were torn down, and the only people who were allowed back in to those units were people who had enough income to support, mm-hmm. you know, the rent that they would require. And most of the units were turned into ownership units, not rental units as mm-hmm. well. So while a lot of people in the city are very happy about that, they feel like it cleaned up the city quite a bit. And some of the people who live in the units feel like it did help get rid of some of the problems that were associated with public housing units. It also displaced a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So there was a, large number of African Americans who lived in these units who never were able to come back.
Mm-hmm. So with this reconfiguration of New Orleans, how do you think it has changed the community sense? And are there still people who feel defeated? I think most people are aware of Dave Eger's powerful book, Zaytoun. And he chronicles the efforts of this one man who had been a very successful immigrant to New Orleans. And, he wound up getting locked up and they couldn't find him. And the process that he went through, if everyone who had a stake in the old New Orleans got treated that way, then it appears that they created these economic barriers so that the only people who could return were those who had deep enough pockets to rebuild their homes without the federal assistance that often took 4 years or longer or actually never even showed up.
Right. So the structure, what I document in the book, I talk about how there were two disasters. The first one was the cause of the flooding in the city after the hurricane, which many have documented is attributable to the fact that there were levees that needed repair that weren't being repaired because of the revolving door relationships between the Army Corps of Engineers and the Federal Emergency Management Association and the subcontracting companies, Halliburton, Bechtel, the Shaw Group, who were responsible for rebuilding these. And essentially, because of those revolving door relationships where senior officials in government were also working as executives in these companies and rotation back and forth, which Naomi Klein documents in her book, The Shock Doctrine, mm-hmm. they agreed not to rebuild. They agreed that it was a low priority to work on American infrastructure like this. Instead, they wanted to put money into building prisons in Iraq and funding the war effort. It was more profitable to go where the oil was, even though there's oil in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first disaster. The reason that the flooding happened was because of neglect on the part of the government and these subcontracting organizations. The second disaster was the way that these same principles of subcontracting played out in the way money was given out, federal money was given out to people who wanted to rebuild. And yes, only the people who were able to really rebuild were those who already had resources. They were the ones who could rebuild. And what I say in the book is that everyone was affected. Everyone was devastated and everyone lost a lot because of the flooding and the damage. But in the end, the people who could rebuild the most quickly and without as much fear of never being able to return were the people who had resources to begin with. So people who didn't have a stake in the market, people who didn't have ownership of a home, people who didn't own a rental unit, people who didn't have good insurance that they could fight with through lawsuits that lasted years and years, mm-hmm. really didn't have the ability to come back. Mm-hmm. And some of them who did stay are much poorer now than they used to be.
Well, let's talk about Helen LaMarche,
mm-hmm.
because she's one of the people you profile in the book, and she had resources. She owned a horse ranch, and the family had money, and she basically had to revert to using barter to keep herself afloat and to kind of restart her business. And she says that the losses that she'll never reclaim exceeded, about $600,000 in her case. So even people who had some resources and were successful couldn't navigate the system to get the relief that they needed. And it appears that everywhere you went, whether it's an insurance company that said, we don't cover water damage, and then you say you prove it was wind damage and a Category 3 or Category 4, and they say, oh, never mind. Mm-hmm. And so it was a whole pass-the-buck mentality. And even people who knew how to navigate the system were unable to make it work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Even people like Helen LaMarche, who really was, as she said, with her family, running a business worth $11 million, lost huge amounts and realized at some point in around the first year after the storm that they weren't going to get the help they needed. Even though they had insurance, it wasn't going to be enough. Insurance was going to claim that they didn't have coverage for floods. They only had coverage for storm damage. And that their own resources were not going to be enough for them to fall back on. Businesses were lost. Their entire family business was underwater, covered with mud. They had no way to, as she talks about it, the real shock for her was realizing that not only had she lost her home, but she had lost her livelihood. She had no way to make money to help herself rebuild. So this was the sort of lowest of the low points for most people when they realized that they were going to have to dig out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And there were reasons that they all got to this point. We can talk about that later, because the second half of the book really is about how they rebuilt, not on their own, but with help from volunteers and faith-based groups from all over the country. But the structure of recovery for people like her was such that even though she had money, she wasn't able to access money to help herself rebuild. And this is even though the government gave huge amounts of money to help with that process.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about Road Home. This is the entity that was created to take federal dollars, profits were lopped off the top, and then some of that money actually trickled down in the form of relief and loans and reconstruction grants, but the percentages were way out of whack. And you show that repeatedly there were large pools of capital that were not being put to work, and that bonuses were being paid to the corporate people who ran the programs, but that, you know, if they had simply given the money that they charged the government for a single FEMA trailer to the person they put in that trailer, they would have been able to rebuild their homes.
Right. It's a really hard thing to get at the specifics, even though these organizations claim that they're transparent. But the government of Louisiana worked with the federal government to set up the Louisiana Recovery Authority. And underneath that umbrella, a program called the Road Home Program was established. And it was intended to give funding to primarily to homeowners, but also owners of rental properties eventually. Not renters, but people who owned their home. The money that would fill in the gap between what insurance paid and what the value of their home was or the cost of rebuilding it. So everyone was very excited about this program. There was a lot of money put into the program. And people found very early on that it was very hard to get money from the Road Home program. A few people got large chunks of money right off the bat, sort of random even. But most people found that even after 2 years, they were still struggling to get responsiveness from the Road Home program. Even up to year four, for some people, they were still not able to get their money out. And what you can find out by looking at the public record, although you can't get the real details, it's not entirely transparent how they were spending their money or how they made their calculations. But what we do know is that the money that they were given also paid for large bonuses to their executives, large resources that were put into making sure their stock portfolio held very strong. In fact, the company that designed it. So what we do know is that the government was not running the program. The government mm-hmm. subcontracted the program to a company called ICF International, and they designed the program. They were actually working with the government before the program was started to design this program, and then got the contract in a no-bid contract situation. Mm-hmm. Because it was an emergency, a federal emergency. And so they ran the program for 3 years, and their stock immediately, you know, you can see this in the public record too, their stock soared right after they got the contract, mm-hmm. and it continued to stay strong and grow throughout the years. And they talk about that online as if it's something they're quite proud of, actually. And it doesn't make sense when you compare it to what the people on the ground in New Orleans were really dealing with. People were being told that their paperwork was lost.
Mm-hmm.
People were being told that their houses were worth much less than what they had been valued at before. people were being told that there were delays for this reason and that reason. People within the company that they were working with were changing hands all the were being replaced all the time. So the norm, we interviewed 163 people altogether over a four-year period. We interviewed them every 6 months to a year to mark their progress. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the norm from almost all of these interviews was that people were frustrated with Road Home and were not getting satisfaction over multiple years.
Well, you write in the book, as of November 2010, almost 5 years after Katrina, the Road Home program reported that it had received 229,000 applications, but had awarded funds to only 128,000, which is a ratio of about 45%. So the other 55%, they're just told
people
to
didn't get any money at
take
all.
A hike?
Right. So a lot of times they said that these are people who weren't legitimately homeowners because they couldn't show title on their home. There were a lot of reasons people couldn't show title on their home.
You point out that African Americans historically used a different approach to land titles because of discrimination.
Well, so there are many reasons. Sometimes in some neighborhoods, families had lived in their homes for multiple generations, and the title was in the name of a grandparent, and the grandparent was no longer alive. But the family, because they didn't have mortgages, they didn't have necessarily insurance on their property, they never changed the title. They couldn't get, even though they could show that it was their grandparent, they couldn't get a Road Home fund because mm-hmm. the title wasn't in their name. Sometimes it was because one of the cases that I profile here, it was a couple, an African American couple who had lived in a middle class neighborhood for many years. He was a 3-time Purple Heart recipient, fought in Vietnam War. His wife was a retired clerk from City Hall. And they had purchased their home through a bond for deed sale, which was a route of buying through from the owner, the previous owner. And it was a route that many African-American families used because during the 1970s, it was hard to get conventional mortgages from banks because of discrimination.
Redlining, yeah.
And so the Road Home Corporation, the Road Home people, didn't even know what a bond for deed sale was. If you talk to the wife in this mm-hmm. case, she told me she went into the offices and they hadn't even heard of that kind of transaction. Mm-hmm. And so they were denied Road Home funds. It's a very sad story, actually.
Your book is a pretty stinging indictment written in very polite terms of the privatization of disaster relief.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes, that's what we call a softball opening.
Yes.
Tell us, why does privatized disaster relief not sit well with you? What are the problems? I mean, it's brilliant. Well, you got this lame government. It's broken. The Bush administration proved that by its failed response to Katrina and by sending Michael Brown there, who now is a radio talk show host in Denver, by the way. I find that bizarre. At any rate, this was an administration that wanted the government to fail so they could point a finger and say, government doesn't work, therefore we're going to privatize this, and we're going to bring in the same fabulous people that profited from our occupation of Iraq right here in New Orleans.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was a deliberate conspiracy on the part of the government to do that. I think that there have been engines in place in the government, in the governance, the way we govern ourselves, the way government runs in this country, that have been in place since, the 50s. What some people call neoliberalism, what I use Margaret Summers' phrasing, market-driven governance, to describe this, in which the assumption is that if you let the private sector govern how we allocate our resources and how we design our programs for everything from the public safety net to the building of roads and bridges and other things, then we will succeed. And, there's good reason to think that does work in some cases. It does work in some sectors. But what I am trying to show in this book is how when we allow that model of governance to really seep into the running of institutions that are designed to be a safety net. And the case of post-disaster is a good example of that. When people really need humanitarian relief, the market-run businesses get in the way. So, yes, it is an indictment of that. But I don't think it's just the Bush administration. I think that it's government now. It's mm-hmm. the way we've been heading for 40 or 50 years now, and it's not working. There are ways in which it is working very well, and there are ways in which it is not working. I mean, the big second part of the book is about how privatizing government has led to this idea that we should not have government providing relief, that we should let the private sector do that. And of course, that means, on the one hand, letting subcontractors like Halliburton and Bechtel go in and provide the resources for recovery. And I mean, I you mentioned before the FEMA trailer story, and it's true. I mean, FEMA provided trailers to people in New Orleans to house them in the immediate aftermath. And year four, after people were still living in their trailers, trying to rebuild their homes, waiting for road home money, waiting for insurance money, FEMA offered initially to allow people to buy their FEMA trailers for $25,000. And people were a little outraged at that. But then they found out they were full of formaldehyde and toxic. So they rescinded that offer. But it was learned. You wonder, why did they want to charge for them? Well, it turns out, from reports that I could gather, the organizations that were subcontracted, the companies that were subcontracted, including Halliburton and Bechtel, were paid about $229,000 apiece to build each trailer and send it to New Orleans. Jeez. So they made huge money on the supplying mm-hmm. of FEMA trailers. And so giving, on the one hand, you give some companies like that the ability to go in and do the work. On the other hand, what the privatization of government does is it turns over a lot of the relief work to nonprofit charity groups, including now since Bush's push for 1,000 points of light, which was really an attempt to put these efforts into the hands of church groups in mm-hmm. the U.S. And that's how it's played out. So who rebuilt New Orleans? Faith-based and non-faith-based non-governmental private charities rebuilt New Orleans.
We're talking with Vince Ann Adams. Her new book is Markets of Sorrow, Labors of Faith, New Orleans in the Wake of Katrina. And Dr. John wants to jump in here for a second.
Empty words. Empty words. Go to the White House. Be with life. Be with life. Be with life. Set you free. Children hungry, living in the streets. Children are hurting and they wind up in the streets. Children are crying and they're dying in the streets. And the truth will set you free.
Children are dying in the streets, and the truth will set you free. That's Dr. John, and it's called Promises, Promises. And if we just put it in a ballpark term, Professor Adams, what percentage of the promises to the people of New Orleans were kept? Can you hazard a guess?
Well, I think the government did give a lot of money. It's whether it made it to the people who needed it, and it's whether they were able to do what they needed to do to rebuild. So, mm-hmm. In another sense, all the promises were kept. The government that orchestrated the relief effort gave money to subcontracting companies that made money on that effort and denied funds to a lot of people, gave some to some, but mm-hmm. denied it to a lot, kept the engines of profit-making going around the disaster, again, disaster capitalism, and also allowed the private faith-based NGO sector, charity sector, to do most of the work. Mm-hmm. So that was by design. All their promises were kept.
Now, to transition from the profiteers to the NGOs, you tell many great anecdotes in the book of the people affected by this, and you explain these policy issues through their experiences. And one that tickled me is Mark Tatum. He lived in an old home that he'd been working on since before Katrina hit. And you say that he showed you a video that he shot when he returned to his house right after the flood. It showed mud everywhere. Long shots documented the world that he came back to. It took an hour to get through the first third of the video. Wow. Then you say his situation got worse. His wife left him. She moved to her home state in the Midwest to be with her mother. His kids went with her. He said she just couldn't stay here anymore. And then he talked a lot, you say, about Jesus. And at one point you say, even with the support he got from Jesus, Mark was not doing well. He was lost without his family. His loneliness made his lack of focus more apparent. He might have had a diagnosable condition, but it was hard to say. So here was a man of faith who was struggling through this. And then we turn to the twin initiatives of Bush Père et Fils. Father Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, had done a speech called 1,000 Points of Light, his Kinder, Gentler initiative. And there's a foundation that bears that name. They were knee-deep in relief work in New Orleans. And then George Bush Jr., George W. Bush, courted evangelical voters with his office in the White House for faith-based initiatives. So the kind of Bush efforts in the nonprofit sector were put to the test here in New Orleans. And in your book, you give a lot of detail about various nonprofit groups, community organizations, and others who really stepped in when the profit-taking road home and these other efforts failed to help rebuild homes. And time and again, you recount how the real work done to put people's houses back together and put people back into those homes was done by volunteers.
Yes, absolutely. And everyone in New Orleans will say the same thing. They weren't all faith-based volunteers, but definitely volunteers were. I mean, it was both people of New Orleans getting in the mud, digging through the mess, digging their way out, and keeping to it despite moments repeatedly that made them feel like they had to leave. And then the volunteers who came down. And there are so many examples of this. You know, the City Park group, the Good News Camp that was set up, seemed like a spontaneous, it was actually a faith-based ministries group that set that up, had 17,000 volunteers over the years. And actually, the Points of Light Institute was not the first there. Mm-hmm. Points of Light Institute indirectly, well, now it's merged with an organization called Hands On, which is a very large umbrella group that organizes and orchestrates a lot of the volunteering in the U.S. overall, including Teach for America and AmeriCorps and other things. And they came later, in some sense, to, they might have been funneling money to some of the smaller groups that were there, but their visible presence came later after, in 2011, they held their national conference there because they were showcasing New Orleans as an example of what you can do with volunteer efforts. So it was a very positive story in that sense, although I'm more skeptical about it toward the end of the book.
I picked that up.
Get to.
and I'm interested in a term you introduce, philanthrocapitalism. So that is taking profits while you're handing out money. I mean, we think of philanthropists like, you know, wealthy individuals who set up a foundation, a Ford, a Rockefeller, a Carnegie, and they give their money away. They don't attempt to make a profit on the distribution of that money. But philanthrocapitalism is a new kind of hybrid model.
It is, exactly. And Michael Bishop writes a lot about this. I'm not the only one who's writing about this. I'm documenting how it played out in New Orleans. But yeah, it is a new model that tries to blend the best of the sort of corporate ideas of how you make a business and make it sustainable with the humanitarian effort of putting money to social purposes and socially good uses, either social justice purposes or efforts like this to rebuild and handle charity.
Let me cite from your book, Hands On New Orleans is considered a model of a nationally based, federally funded public-private partnership that uses federal support, corporate philanthropy, and partnerships with multiple local grassroots volunteer-based organizations to help communities in need. Its largest funder is the Corporation for National and Community Service, an independent agency of the U.S. government founded under the direction of Stephen Goldsmith during the first Bush president's term back in 88 to 92 in his mission to create, quote, 1,000 points of light. What is your evaluation of this public-private partnership? I'm all in favor of extracting philanthropy from corporations because they're not paying any taxes here.
Right.
So that part doesn't offend me. But the idea that we're really corrupting the nonprofit model, and I'm not talking about, you know, 501c4s for political purposes, but, you know, it seems that we're now putting new standards on nonprofits to measure their effectiveness by kind of corporate profit standards or business school standards.
Yeah, there are three things I would point to. The first is just what you're talking about and what I saw happening in New Orleans, where small grassroots groups get up and running. They don't have an income stream. Then they start having to write grants to get their money to keep themselves going. They ultimately often are forced to look to corporations to give them money. And it would be one thing if corporations just gave them money as a tax write-off. But increasingly what we're seeing is this blurring of the interests of the corporation with the interests of the nonprofit around the idea that the nonprofit should run more like a business and that they have to come up with self-sustaining strategies and they should think about their bottom line. And that often corrupts the mission of the nonprofit. So it's a problem for them, even though it can work in some cases. Another problem is just the idea that we should be allowing the corporate sector to allocate our public money in this way. If it went through the government would decide how to allocate those resources in ways that were based on democratic voting and on priorities that the public sets. But when the corporation is in charge, it really sets the agenda based on what the corporation wants, and it can. And that's happening all over the place. I mean, look at the Gates Foundation in the world of international health. It's the Gates agenda. It's not the World Health Organization agenda that's being followed. And that may be aligned with the public interest, but it may not be in some cases. And so there's a real compromise there. And then the third thing that I point to in the book, which is somewhat frightening to me, is that when we start to see the nonprofit charity sector as a money stream, as a profit stream, or as a sector that can generate profits, what are we really making money on? We're making money off of misery. We're making money off of people who are poor and who need help. We're making money off of the existence of poverty. And of course, there's a very sort of strange, vicious cycle that you could think about in all of this, in which people who are working for nonprofits aren't getting paid, right? So it's free labor or underpaid labor in the case of some of the
AmeriCorps
work that gets done, AmeriCorps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet the companies are making money off of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what really got me was when I found out that this company that ran the Road Home program called ICF International had, after it finished its contract with the Road Home program, which was then given over to another company, which is a subsidiary, apparently, of ICF, it went on to, and it's a huge corporation. I mean, ICF has subcontracts with the government that are vast and wide. But one of the things that I learned about that it has done recently is it started turning its attention to, get this, nonprofit, faith-based neighborhood organizations.
Oh.
So they're looking at, now what they failed to do through the Road Home program, they're now looking to partner with nonprofit faith-based groups to do the same thing. So they'll profit not once, but twice on the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And that just when I told my friends in New Orleans about this, they, you know, one of them said, that just makes me sick.
Well, when I got to your chapter on philanthrocapitalism, and that is a mouthful, I wrote in the margin, United Way. It kind of reminds me of the, you know, these corporate fund drives where they get companies to compete either internally or with their, you know, other outside competitors, you know, who can raise the most for the United Way. But then the money is spent in ways that are approved by the donors, those who control the corporations that participate. And most of it goes to good causes. I'm not trying to demonize the United Way, but it's not pure charity. It is structured in a way that extracts money from employees, and the corporations get an image benefit from participating, and sometimes they match the employee contributions. But it is often a way to make corporations look good at the lowest possible cost.
Well, I mean, I agree with you on some measure. I don't think that it's fair to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater on the possibility of organizations like this doing good work. They do good work. And the larger they are, the more they look like a corporation, as you say. My fear is that we've become so accustomed to thinking of the solutions to our social problems as being ones that can be solved by the market, that there's absolutely no regulation of how they run or what they spend their money on. There are some nonprofit groups like Charity Navigator that are springing up, which are organized around this idea that we should be reporting on how they spend their money. Let's look at their finances. Let's look at how much their executives are paid. Let's look at how much goes to the actual people in need out of this. And of course, my own theory is that the smaller the organization, the more effective they're going to be at doing direct aid, and the mm-hmm. bigger, the least effective they're going to be because they have to run a big corporation. The problem is that we've just slipped into this place where we think less regulation is better on all this. And I frankly don't think that if you're doing a nonprofit, you should be earning the same amount of money as a for-profit corporation. I think that there's a reason you're called nonprofit. And so, you know, like all this flap about the IRS investigating, I mean, it's ironic about it is I certainly am you know, I would be as upset as the next person that if the IRS were really targeting one political party over another in terms of the nonprofits that are supported by it. But I do think the bigger question is, what is the regulation of nonprofits? What are they allowed to do and not allowed to do, not in politics, but in actual money-making things? Mm-hmm. I mean, where do you set the limits on allowing that to be a source of profit? Because, as I said, ultimately, having that as a goal will impede your ability to do the work itself.
Toward the end of the book, you write, "What is perverse in these arrangements is the penetration of for-profit corporate interest into this sector of the humanitarian economy. This results in an awkward situation in which nonprofits find themselves uneasily managing the slippage between fiscal and humanitarian outcomes. As philanthrocapitalism and solicitations of venture philanthropy help to pay for charity, the demands on nonprofits to act like for-profits are escalated. Such arrangements also allow public-private corporations to become for-profit partners in the new charity economy. The privatization and marketization of charity disaster and recovery efforts, all the way from rescue operations to rebuilding communities, allow for all sorts of new circulations of capital from disaster and human suffering." What do you mean by new circulations of capital?
Well, it's pushing capital, that's pushing the resources that we have. As I said before, it was the same idea of if we have a strong government that actually takes public resources and puts them back into people in need or things that we all benefit from, public services of one sort or another, national health care, for example, then we're organized around a system that actually cares about the public more than it cares about the profit. But when you have all of these relationships of government paying companies to run nonprofits and to fund nonprofits or to make money off of nonprofit charitable activities, it's very easy for the other end of things, the profit end of things, to become the governing infrastructure. So regardless of what the needs are, profit becomes the bottom line again. Circuits, what I mean by circulations of capital is that it's the way money's flowing through the system and what it's allowing to emerge from that, whether it's allowing needs to be taken care of or whether it's allowing more profits to be made.
Mm-hmm. Vince Ann Adams, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate what you reported in your book, and I recommend it to people. It's called Markets of Sorrow, Labors of Faith, New Orleans in the Wake of Katrina. We've been talking with Professor Vince Ann Adams from the University of California, San Francisco. And Dr. John will take us out with a little more upbeat message. This one's called We Gettin' There. Company's screwed up. My pocket lost his jaw in his marriage. Like dominoes falling down the block. Got strung out on lush and narcotics. Walking around like he's in a state of shock. His paint to Sudan ain't living on. In New Orleans, if you care, yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you wonder how we do it.
is Bill kidding me? Wanna sit down with a friend, talk about it over a cup of coffee, but he couldn't even make his nut move to another city way over in Mississippi. Frustration and despair could kill a man. Is already did just that. Ask anybody if they know a friend to die from suicide. Don't say yeah for that. Still paying taxes, jack the rents in New Orleans if you can.
If you can.